Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
We're honored today to have a very special out-of-state guest, Chief Justice Bridget McCormack of the Michigan Supreme Court. Chief Justice McCormack, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Probably a lot of our listeners may already know you from social media, but for those that don't, can you kind of tell us a little bit about your background, where you came from, that kind of stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. I've been serving on the Michigan Supreme Court since January 2013. I was elected in November 2012. But before that, I was on the faculty at the University of Michigan Law School. And before that, taught at Yale Law School for a couple of years. And before that, I started my career in New York City as a public defender. I've had a few different phases of my legal career so far, all pretty different.
It's interesting because not typically around here do we hear about people going from being professors in law school to a state court appellate bench. That's kind of a cool transition to get there. How did you decide that you wanted to be an appellate justice?
It's a great question. I agree with you. You don't see it nowadays very often. It used to be somewhat common. I mean, some of the sort of important justices in Michigan's history cycled through the court and the law and the University of Michigan Law School somewhat regularly. Justice Cooley has an important place not only in Michigan Supreme Court history, but in University of Michigan Law School history. And that was not uncommon historically, but has been, I think, is far less common nowadays. You're more likely to see law school faculty members go to the federal bench, like Justice Barrett, for example. Justice Larson, who was my colleague on the Michigan Supreme Court, was quickly elevated to the Sixth Circuit, but she was also my colleague at the University of Michigan Law School. So I agree with that. You don't see it in state courts that often. I frankly was far more interested in the state appellate court than the federal courts. State courts is where most people have to go to access justice, or where most people have to go when someone wants to access justice from them. You know, state courts handle 95% of the civil and the criminal cases. So they play such an important role in so many of our neighbors' lives that I find the work that they do for me especially compelling. My work at the law school, I did teach some traditional stand-up classes like criminal law, but I primarily taught clinical classes where my students were representing people who couldn't otherwise afford lawyers in a bunch of different contexts, a variety of contexts. Since thinking about access to justice and kind of the gaps in our system of justice has been something I've been doing for my whole career. And state courts is where we can make big progress. Mm-hmm. Federal courts, I don't even know what they do. Do they have any cases? Not sure.
What law do they apply?
Exactly.
Well, we hear about prestige factors in judicial clerkships, federal versus state. And I think that's a point that's lost on a lot of applicants is what you just brought up. If I may call you Chief as a shorthand rather than Chief Justice McCormack every time, that is something that's sometimes lost in the judicial clerkship application process. Mm-hmm. Is just the value that comes out of a state court clerkship in the sense that you're getting so much more experience in that real world. And in things that if you're going to go practice as a litigator in Michigan, you know, things that would be just very useful to you in your practice. Would you agree?
That's especially true if you know you're going to litigate in the state. But I think it's just as valuable if you're never going to litigate in Michigan, but you can clerk on the Michigan Supreme Court, or you're never going to litigate in California, but you can clerk on the California Supreme Court, or you're never going to litigate in Texas, frankly, but you can clerk for one of the great justices on that court. I do think there is a breadth and depth of experience you get on a state Supreme Court just because of the volume of cases that we see that is unique and a really worthwhile experience. I know that, I mean, I went to NYU Law School, I taught at Yale, I taught at Michigan, so I'm like very familiar with the clerkship process focusing almost entirely on the federal courts. And I don't understand it because I think state Supreme Court clerkships and even intermediate appellate court clerkships give such valuable experience. And there are some really tremendous mentors on a lot of those courts who will spend a lot of time with their clerks and make sure they get a lot out of those clerkships. I have to say, I'm seeing more applications from people all over the, I mean, I always get great applicants from the University of Michigan Law School. I continue to teach there. So I, you know, have my hands in there to find good clerks and I get great applicants from there, but I'm getting good applicants from lots of top law schools nowadays. So I'm hoping there's some of that is changing a little bit.
Spend less time analyzing data and more time digging into the facts with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge. Powered by the largest collection of federal and state dockets, litigation analytics instantly aggregates data points to produce information such as likely timeline, outcomes, representation, and damages from which you can base your case strategy and assess potential litigation costs and resources and position yourself for success. Gain a strategic edge using data-driven insights with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge. Todd is a former Texas Supreme Court clerk, and I spent two of my years in law school clerking in a state trial court. So we're both big proponents of state court clerkships on this podcast as well. Tell us a little bit about the Michigan court structure. Is the Michigan Supreme Court criminal and civil court that has discretionary review?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I know in Texas you have two, you have a criminal supreme and a civil supreme, and your Chief Justice Hecht is a good friend of mine, and I am a big fan of his. We've been working on a lot together over the last year and a half. But in Michigan, we just have one Supreme Court, and all civil and all criminal cases can come to us, but we have a wholly discretionary docket. We don't have any automatic jurisdiction or mandatory jurisdiction, I should say. So we decide our docket every year. We have an intermediate appellate court, and then we have different trial courts, circuit, district, and probate, probably pretty similar to Texas in that way, I would think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have a lot of different trial court designations.
Yeah, actually, I think I followed a little bit of that in some litigation around bail. I didn't understand what some of those courts were. I was trying to figure out like what the definitions were.
Our trial court system is, I think, sort of unique. And historically, there's been movements to try and change it and consolidate it. But when you have 254 little fiefdoms, it's hard to get any consensus on how that should be done. If I heard you right, though, Chief, you have one intermediate appellate court in Michigan.
There is one intermediate appellate court. There are 26 or 7 judges who sit in panels of three. Mm. So it's one court. They sit in panels of three and they sit at least three places in the state. Every once in a while, one of their panels will travel to the Upper Peninsula. Michigan has this whole other part that's across the lake, but they're doing a lot of work.
Well, I asked because we had Judge Dillard from Georgia on the show as well. And I was somewhat surprised that a state the size of Georgia had just one intermediate appellate court. That's a large number of judges, of course, as you mentioned on that court, but we're used to our 14 intermediate appellate courts that we have in our state that is geographically situated. So
their own independent jurisdiction and their own independent cases. And it creates some interesting issues, especially in Houston, where you have two courts with the exact same geographic jurisdiction that write separately.
Why? I don't even know.
Excellent question.
If we could answer that.
Yeah.
Wow.
We can't, unfortunately.
That's a lot. That's confusing.
It's very confusing, especially if you're in Houston and you have one court going one way and the other court going the other way. You just sort of have to guess which one's going to get your case.
Yikes.
You know, this is Texas. What can we say?
We have to do things as differently and confusing as we can.
Right. Keep it interesting.
So how does Michigan select their judges? Here, you know, everything is a partisan election from the justice of the peace, kind of small claims court, all the way up to the Texas Supreme Court.
Well, Michigan judges are elected as well. For the most part, they're elected on the nonpartisan section of the ballot. I say for the most part, because there is this one place, pretty important place, where the parties do play a role. And that is for the Supreme Court, the parties nominate candidates. They then appear on the nonpartisan section of the ballot. But when the parties play a role in the nomination process, as you might imagine, it does invest them in the race in a way that makes it a little less nonpartisan than it might otherwise be. In the lower courts, in the trial courts, in the Court of Appeals, judges or judicial candidates can collect signatures and make their way to the nonpartisan section of the ballot. And it really is nonpartisan. The party isn't playing any role. That's not to say that people don't go to local party events for support or et cetera, but it's different from the Supreme Court elections, which have a sort of a bigger place for the political parties to play.
And then you're elected for 8-year terms on the appellate court?
On the Supreme Court, we're elected for 8-year terms. The Court of Appeals and the trial courts are 6-year terms. I will say, and this probably is true most places, it is pretty uncommon for a candidate to make it to the bench unless there's an open seat without getting nominated and filling a vacancy. A lot of people make it there the first time because in any vacancy, the governor appoints without any oversight. The governor just appoints to vacancies. And then if you've been appointed by the governor, you have to run in the next general election, but you're running with the designation under your name as the incumbent. So it's a tremendous advantage. It's unusual for a candidate to get to the bench the first time by way of election, although I did that. That is how I got there.
How was it going from being in academia and being a law professor to running in a statewide, I guess, nonpartisan, but still political election?
I had no idea what I was getting into. And had I known it at the front end, I honestly don't think I would have done it. I don't think it would have been for me. I mean, I had this like naive idea that I could contribute on this court. A lot of the clinical work I did with my students was appellate work. And so I was in the Michigan Supreme Court somewhat regularly, felt like I had a good reputation and good relationships with the bench. In fact, the year that I was running, there's an annual competition for the best brief filed in that court, and I won the award that year while I was running. So I felt like I might be able to contribute. And I thought, you know, I have this different background that's useful on a multi-member court. I think the whole idea of the multi-member court is different people with different experiences bring different perspectives to a conversation, helps you get to a better answer. And I thought, well, mine would be a good contribution. I know what I'll do. I'll just run for statewide office. And that was one of the most naive things I've ever done in my life. But here I am. So, I mean, once I started and I was like, wow, this is a whole thing. But then I wanted to, you know, but I wanted to then at that point do it well. So I tried to figure it out and I ended up the top vote getter.
You know? You may be the only person I've ever met that went straight from faculty teaching gig to elected office as an appellate judge.
Yeah, it's definitely, usually you would want to know a little bit more about running for office. I hear the critique and I accept it. Yeah.
Maybe it's a good thing to not have known and then you got to just jump in with both feet.
It could be. You know, sometimes it's those audibles you call in your career that turn out to make a whole lot of sense in hindsight. If you had overplanned, you might never have found that door open. So, yeah.
Now you started as an associate justice on the court. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And then you became chief. How does the process of becoming chief justice work on your court?
On our court, the court decides. We have an election for the chief every 2 years. So in January of 2019, my colleagues elected me chief and then re-elected me this past January. So I'm serving my second 2-year term as chief. And typically in Michigan, we just do 2-year terms. So I probably will only be the chief for another year and a couple of months.
So does that come along with additional administrative responsibilities? What's the real difference between being chief and an associate justice?
Yeah, it does. I mean, the chief, for the decision-making work of the court, you know, the chief has the privilege of herding the cats and figuring out when we're conferencing what and what we have to get done and how we get it done and keeping on top of the work, as well as deciding a lot of the incoming motions that are just chief justice motions. But it's the administrative work of the courts that's the significant lift. It's also, in my view, the place where we have the ability to impact most people in the most important ways. So I happen to really enjoy the administrative side of the job. But like in Texas, we have a talented state court administrator. I'm also a huge David Slayton fan, but we have a David Slayton like person in Michigan who's fantastic as well, and a lot of talented people who work for and with him. And there's a lot going on, especially the last 15 months. So the administrative part of the job has been significant. I will say that the justices all share in that. And in fact, a number of them do significant lifting on the administrative side of the job. In fact, I think there are a number of them that seem to enjoy it as much as I do. And so they have jumped in with both feet and have taken full responsibility for whole areas of administrative work, which is an enormous help to me.
I would imagine that it really helped a lot to have others helping to row the boat in the same direction when the pandemic hit and there was all this extra stuff that the court had to consider.
Yes, absolutely. I've said a number of times what we've seen happen in courts in the last 15 months, it has been tremendous in my view. I mean, we've seen more change in 15 months than 15 decades, but it was all born of an emergency. You know, we had to figure out both how to make sure people could continue to access justice and what that means, and how to keep them safe. And it required of us innovation that provided a tremendous opportunity, but I couldn't have done it without the help of excellent colleagues. I will say that.
How did the Michigan courts respond to the pandemic?
I've been incredibly proud of how the courts have responded. We had a bit of a head start. We had the Supreme Court, our administrative office of the courts, had purchased Zoom licenses and the hardware, so the software and the hardware for every trial judge in the state, a full 8 months before COVID. I wish wow. I could, I know, right? We were like, I think I'm the only, we were the only state in the country that literally had it ready to go. Now, that doesn't mean that most of those judges had ever used those Zoom licenses once. I'm fairly confident that many had not, but they had everything they needed so that with some quick training and support from a sort of rapid response work we set up, they were able to transform what they did really quickly to remote platforms. And as you know, I think we've learned that a lot of what we do in courts translates quite well to this platform and some stuff less well. It'll be really nice when we can, which I guess we're almost here, can start making those choices so that we can use our Zoom courtrooms for the things that work best there and use our courtrooms for the things that work better there. But Michigan was able to quickly transform the whole state to Zoom platforms. We picked the YouTube channel for live streaming. We quickly set up a directory, a really user-friendly directory, a map of the state of Michigan with all the different counties. And you could click on any county and in the county, see which judges were live in their Zoom courtrooms. And
oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And you can click directly on the link to watch those courtrooms, which was kind of fun for me. I could go every day, go watch a couple of judges around the state. We were in the process of piloting some ODR, some online dispute resolution through an asynchronous platform, absolutely free. We had it in 17 of Michigan's 83 counties, and we just moved the team to get it in all 83 counties within another 8 weeks. So by July 1st, we had statewide ODR for free in asynchronous platforms. I think we're still the only state that has that statewide. We kind of unleashed innovators. We told everybody, like, you know, you were taught in law school that you couldn't be an entrepreneur and now you can. Have fun. Go for it. See what happens. It's been exhausting in a lot of ways, but also exciting in a lot of ways.
Did the court already have rules in place that sort of allowed quick transition to the video platform, or did you have to kind of rethink some of that too?
No, like many other state Supreme Courts, like Texas's, I was following all of the Texas Supreme Court's emergency orders. We issued a series of emergency orders, basically suspending every rule, you know, allowing all of this to take off. So we had to do that. And we're right now in the process of figuring out which of those changes need to be made permanent. How do we support continued transparency, access, and efficiency by the kind of infrastructure that's built up around what we do? So we're trying to figure all that out now.
You had mentioned access to justice earlier. I think everyone we've talked to about this all agrees that this is has a huge potential for changing access to justice in the court system everywhere. And I'm sure your state's the same.
It's the breakthrough I feel like we needed. The access to justice crisis, which is what we have in this country, is, you know, the thing that keeps me up at night more than anything else. I mean, they're like everywhere else, 70 or 80% of Michigan citizens who have a legal problem can't afford a lawyer. And they either, in a civil legal case, obviously if it's a criminal legal case, we provide them lawyers. But in civil cases, they either try to navigate courts on their own, but, you know, we don't make that very easy. We have all these like processes. We use this other language. We make it's pretty discouraging for people who don't speak the language. Or they just give up, right? Most, you know, the number of people who just never showed up when they were served with an eviction notice was incredibly high in most courts in Michigan. And that's true everywhere else. Michigan was not special that way. It's the opposite in these online courtrooms. It literally flipped. Like the number of people who now show up is as high as the number of people who didn't show up in physical courtrooms.
Wow.
It's the most important breakthrough in access to justice that we've had in my career as a lawyer. We've all been talking about it for a long time. We all have understood why it matters. The rule of law is only a set of ideas that depends on our confidence in them. And if you lose the confidence of a significant number of people, you lose the consent of the governed eventually, right? I mean, this is a pretty fundamental problem. Like, people need to feel like they can have equal access to the justice system. And I feel like now we have this opportunity that we just, I don't know if we would have had it without this disruption.
Absolutely. We've seen the same thing here. And we talked to Judge Emily Miskell not too long ago, who does family law. And she was saying in the last year, she really saw people that she had never seen before, which told her that we clearly weren't serving the constituents well in the family law arena, because there were people that just like that, just like evictions, just wouldn't show up. And then all of a sudden now they're here. And it's, she said, it's just been amazing how much it's changed how her docket has run.
Even in some cases where judges were seeing people, they're getting so much more out of them. This is another, you know, the judges in Michigan who have cases where kids are involved, termination of parental rights cases or abuse and neglect cases or juvenile cases, have said regularly that they are getting so much more out of kids on this platform than they ever got. And of course, that makes sense. Like, in retrospect, I feel like courtrooms are intimidating for adults. Sure. They can be intimidating for lawyers, right? I mean, courtrooms can be intimidating. Imagine if you're like an 8-year-old kid and you're in a courtroom, you're not going to open your mouth, but your phone, talking into your phone, you know, the judges say, like, all of a sudden, I haven't heard a thing from this girl in 2 years on my docket. And now she wants to show me her room and show me her homework and show me her brother. And they're just getting better information, which allows them to make better decisions about what the right answer is in these cases. So that's, of course, not to say that it's perfect for everything we do. Of course it's not. But the idea that we might not take the good with us is what I spend a lot of time worrying about lately.
Understandable. I think we've talked about this on this show a lot. It's going to require some tough decisions, but just the room for people to represent themselves and show up, and the room for lawyers to kind of use efficiency to represent people that they wouldn't have been able to reach before, is just so tremendous that, I mean, we're on the same page. We hope that a lot of the stuff that makes sense sticks around.
Love the language that you used. It sounds like you've said these words before, that we've seen more change in the last 15 months than in the last 15 decades. That's a long time for not much change. And truly, I think it's correct. You've described yourself some of the big benefits and the changes that we've seen, but the pandemic truly was a disruption that probably was something like that, or on the order of the pandemic, probably was required to make us get around the corner on some of these issues we've been stuck on for so long.
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing it in all parts of our lives. I was listening to the U of M economist Betsy Stevenson on Ezra Klein's podcast last week, and she was calling that there are so many people quitting jobs right now, leaving jobs, which normally happens. Like, in every economy, there's some number of people that, like, something disruptive happens in their life and they quit their jobs. But all of a sudden, the whole world had the same disruptive thing happened at the same time. So we're seeing the enormous numbers of people leaving jobs. And she's calling it the take this job and shove it phase of the pandemic. And it has these really interesting kind of economic outcomes that, you know, we'll see where they go, but it's a really interesting disruption in the economy. But for our profession, we've been able to resist change better than any other industry I know. And I think there are a lot of understandable reasons for that. I mean, education is a close second to law. But if you look at drawings of courtrooms from the 1918 flu pandemic, they look the same as they did in March 2020. Like, we just have not changed that much. And some of that is cultural. You know, it's just like lawyers are trained to be risk averse. The rules of our discipline are tied to history, right? The rules of the game are what did courts decide in the past? And those are important rules, right? They're important to courts' decision making. But they've ended up playing what I think is a hampering role in the places where we need to innovate. The people who needed to use courts when courthouses were built and rules were built and processes were built, but it was just a much smaller number of people and they all had lawyers. And that's just not true anymore. And if this were transportation, Uber would have taken out the taxi industry or made it at least competitive. But in law, we've been able to, through culture and identity and all these kind of bigger forces, tamp it down until now.
Providing surety bonds for court-related matters is a very niche industry, and there are very few appeal bond specialists who are as experienced as Court Surety Bond Agency. Whether the client is a sophisticated entity or an individual involved in litigation for the first time, CSBA uses its more than 110 years of combined surety experience handling appeal bonds to provide first-class service to its clients. For more information, visit courtsurety.com.
I think about when Texas went to e-filing and kind of the very slow rollout of that process over a period of years. I can't imagine how long it would have taken, or if it ever would have really happened, that we could go to some sort of remote hybrid proceeding model without just not having a choice but to do so.
I don't think so, honestly. I really don't. Said it a million times. I think it was the disruption we needed.
So did your court move to Zoom oral arguments?
We did. We moved to Zoom oral arguments by April of 2020, and we just had our first in-person argument this week on Monday. So it was long time, 15 months of Zoom arguments.
How did you feel like oral arguments adapted to the Zoom platform?
I think oral arguments do fine on the Zoom platform. I prefer the courtroom, and I think most of my colleagues do, but I'm glad we've learned that we have this tool for the cases where it's an emergency. We have to do something somewhat quickly. That happens, especially in, well, I used to say like in election years, for some reason this year, we're still seeing like election emergencies. And I don't understand why, but we are. But those cases sometimes need to be decided quickly, and it's going to be hard to get everybody in one place at one time. And now we have this extra tool. I think for the intermediate appellate court, there are a number of cases that they hear regularly where they're seeing better participation from lawyers than they did in courthouses because lawyers are not compensated for some of those cases. So, for example, in termination or parental rights cases, they're not compensated for the hours they spend doing an appellate argument. And they're much more likely to do it when they don't have to drive a couple hours to a courthouse and park, and they can just tune into a Zoom argument. So I think we see the benefits, but we do so few of them that we'll hope for courtroom arguments most of the time and then use the platform when it makes sense for a lawyer or the court, depending on what the issue is.
What about with the trial courts there in Michigan? Have you started heading back toward live juries, or did you ever do anything with virtual juries? What's been the approach?
Some courts did virtual jury selections during different periods of the pandemic. Michigan sort of was hit really hard in the beginning. And then at the end, we were sort of the last state to emerge from worst parts of the pandemic. But there were times in the middle where there were parts of the state that could proceed with jury trials, but they had to figure out jury selection. And some courts did it on the Zoom platform. And then by the time they got to the 12 or 14, they would then bring them into the courtroom and spread them out. It was the selection part that posed the challenge. I very much hope they continue that, because what we learned, which is what people have learned in other places where they've done it, is a lot more people were willing to show up and be considered for jury service. Like everything else, it removed a barrier for some people who were being excluded. And I think that's important to the rule of law. I think when people, you know, there are very few places where citizens have the right to put a direct check on their government, right? And the jury trial is one of those. And the more people who get to be part of that, the greater we grow public confidence in our branch of government. So I'm strongly considered counseling lawyers and judges to continue to experiment with at least Zoom voir dire. If you want them in the courtroom after that, great. But let's see if we can get more people included in the process.
Well, and to your point, kind of when you were talking about a multi-member court, the more diverse and different backgrounds you can bring to jury service, the better decisions that you're going to get, because you don't have just kind of one, the category of people who can show up for voir dire and come downtown and park and take time off from work, that kind of the traditional veneer, versus people who might not have had those opportunities.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's a different slant on the access to justice observation. Justice means more than just allowing someone access to the courtroom as a litigant. That means participating in the process, doing your civic duty as a juror.
Well, and then the YouTube thing, you had mentioned that earlier. I mean, from a lawyer and a nerd perspective, I love it, because I can drop in on courts anywhere in Texas and see, hey, you know, what are they doing in hearings in El Paso? Even though I would have to take a plane to do that in real life. That's just, I love that part of it. And I think even though we have open courts, they've never really been open in the sense that anybody could just take time and take their day down there. You know, long gone are the days where you'd go to the courthouse square for entertainment. I love that more people can kind of tune in from all over the world and see that stuff.
When I was, you know, my very first job out of law school, I was a public defender in New York City, and in Manhattan. And there were these court watchers, you know, like the criminal courts in Manhattan are fascinating and tragic and hilarious and, you know, everything all in one. And there were like lots of people who would just show up and go from courtroom to courtroom. And those people are still out there. They just now get to watch online. And so more of them can see what's happening. And honestly, I really believe if more people saw what's happening, they would grow trust in government. So
absolutely.
I want them to see.
I'm jealous of that interactive map though, Jody, you know, to be able to pull up a map of the state and just say, oh, what's going on over here? That is pretty neat.
It's a great tool. It's a great tool.
We need to send some suggestion boxes to OCA or the Supreme Court.
David Slayton has seen it many times.
It may not have made circles on Twitter or the internet. I think it has, though, that David is leaving us in Texas and is taking a job with the National Center for State Courts.
I know. It's good for me and bad for you.
Well, he has done a lot to advance the cause of technology and justice here in Texas, and I know he'll do really well in his next post. So we certainly wish him well. I wanted to have him back. He was a guest on our podcast and I wanted to have him back, but I may wait until he gets settled into his new gig and see how that goes for him.
Yeah, he's going to be a huge asset to the National Center and to all of us in state courts across the country who rely on the National Center. David and I have chaired the National Center's post-pandemic planning technology committee for the last year and a few months, and he's a visionary. He really is. So, you know, I'm sorry for Texas. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry to Chief Justice Hecht, but the rest of the country needs him.
Is that really the function of the National Center, though, is to help sort of just coordinate? The name sort of implies it, but coordinate among and between the states on the judicial functions?
Yep. The National Center supports the Conference of Chief Justices and the Conference of State Court Administrators so that we can communicate, collaborate, share resources, support. And the National Center does fantastic work, but I will say in the last year and a half, it's done especially excellent work. It really stepped up to be a clearinghouse for both the problems and solutions that state courts were facing through the pandemic.
It was a wild ride with all of that. And then Texas, poor David, had the added benefit of having to deal with the ransomware attack right in the middle of that too.
And just, yeah.
I'm sure he's ready for a little bit of a change.
I'm not sure it's going to be an easier job, though.
No, probably not, but wow.
His country needed him, so.
They did. While we're on the topic of kind of transparency in courts, I wanted to shift gears a little bit and talk about social media, because I think a lot of our listeners probably know you because you're fairly active on Twitter, which is kind of not unique, but there are, I think, fewer judges on Twitter than a lot of other places. What got you started doing that social media platform?
You know, obviously I started Twitter like a lot of people do when I was running for office. I think that's when back in 2012 or 2011, probably 2012, I got my first Twitter account. I was on Facebook because everybody was, but I mean, I should say I was mostly on Facebook so my parents who live in other places could see pictures of my kids, I think at that point. But Twitter, I first got on for election purposes, but like lots of other, especially appellate lawyers and appellate judges, I found this fun community there and made friends. Judge Dillard and I have become very good friends. We've written a couple pieces together and we like each other a lot, as well as a number of other judges. I mean, I do my own podcast with a number of other women justices who I met on Twitter. So I started, my gateway drug was an election, and then I, you know, got hooked and just enjoy the community there.
That article with Judge Dillard, is that the Tweeting Judges article?
Yeah, it is. And it's about social media and why we think judges should use it. Obviously, judges have limitations while on social media, sure. And I think those are important as well. But nowadays, that's where most people get their information, but not just Twitter, but social media platforms. And we think people have a right to know who their judges are and what their courts are up to, and having their judges engaging on social media is sort of today's equivalent of going to the Knights of Columbus dinner or the community picnic, which isn't to say that we don't want to go to those things too. We do, but a lot of people are on these platforms and we work for them.
Particularly with you having a statewide constituency, it's probably a lot harder to reach people in all the corners, you know, especially in the UP and areas that you don't go necessarily as frequently.
It is. Michigan is enormous. And, you know, even to get between Ann Arbor, Lansing, and Detroit in a day, I'm going to be in my car 5.5 hours. And that's somewhat inefficient. And so we now know we have these tools for making what we do more transparent. So I regularly tweet whenever the court has oral arguments, so people have the live feed. I tweet them the link to the summaries of the cases we're going to hear, as well as any other work the court is up to or doing. And the court itself has a very active Twitter account, the Michigan Supreme Court, and does the same thing.
Todd and I are both appellate Twitter members, and that's actually how we started this podcast and got connected, was on Twitter. So we're big proponents of judges, and particularly appellate judges, using social media because it benefits all of us, we think.
It's been really great to get to know and chat with judges from other states and see that they're so much of the common mind. Even though you're separated geographically, there's a general agreement among the people, especially who are doing it right, that it's something that you should do as judges, to really reach out and touch the constituency, let the folks know what the court is up to. And the judges really don't need to be afraid of it. They just need to know a few basic ground rules, which are things you already know anyway, right? I mean, your judicial canons just kind of are the overarching control of what you do in your public life.
You wouldn't do it at the local town hall meeting. Don't do it on social media. I mean, it doesn't feel that hard to me. I mean, yeah, it means there are things judges shouldn't talk about on social media, but you wouldn't talk about them at a local public in-person meeting either. I'm always a little bit confused by judges who think there's an extra scary level about social media. And it worries me about what they're doing at their in-person meetings. What are you doing? I want to know.
You had mentioned your podcast, and we wanted to highlight that because it's a great podcast and it's a great resource. It's Lady Justice, Women of the Court. I'll let you kind of tell us what it is and who's on it.
Yeah, it's been a really fun project. It's a podcast I do with Rhonda Wood, justice on the Arkansas Supreme Court, and Beth Walker, a justice on the West Virginia Supreme Court, and former Justice Eva Guzman from the Texas Supreme Court. And we just wrapped our first season, as it were. And Justice Guzman is no longer Justice Guzman. So we have to figure out if we're going to replace her, go with three, have a rotating fourth in season two. And we're talking about that. But it's been a fun, really fun podcast, because even though we have the same job, our courts do things differently. Our constitutions are structured differently. Our norms are different. And then we have lots of things that are quite similar. And so we've talked both all of those topics and then some. We had a whole episode about mental health and resources for lawyers and judges. And it's been a really fun conversation to have with these amazing women who have the same job I have, but in really different places. It's been a lot of fun.
I really enjoy getting to hear about the way that different states approach very similar issues in different ways, but they all work kind of in their unique settings. And talking about state courts, I think that's one of the great things about state courts is you can do things very differently and still come to some good resolutions.
Yeah.
Well, Judge, we've been so blessed to have you as our guest today, and we're coming toward the time that we usually allocate to do this. We want to make sure that you have plenty of time to handle your ordinary business for the day, but you've been so gracious with your time.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
I do want to give you the opportunity, though, as is our tradition, to discuss maybe an advocacy tip or a war story from your time on the bench, if you had one that you might care to share with us.
I'm not good at war stories because I always feel bad for the losing warrior a lot. So I'm sort of a whatever happens in the Hall of Justice stays in the Hall of Justice, except it doesn't, because it's all on the Supreme Court's YouTube channel. So it's right there for everybody to see. I've said a lot of times, I think the most important tip I have for people who are arguing in the state's highest court is to show up ready to be kind of a thought partner with us. We only decided to hear your case because it was hard. And so we're there with some questions that we're just not sure about. And the sooner you let us get to those and be ready to just help us work through those hard questions, the better. I can't tell you how many times I leave the bench and go to conference and can say, I think this is what the rule of law should be. I don't know what that means about who wins. I just don't. Like, I don't know if that means it, somebody help me. Somebody connect the dots for me. I think it might mean this side wins, but I'm not sure. We're only here in your case because there were some hard questions. So the sooner you can just get to those and you like the hard ones, then the better for us.
I think that's a wonderful piece of advice. It makes me think, how I might approach it differently when next time I have an argument. Because as an advocate, it's not always the thing you want to deal with right up front is the hard question.
I know.
But it's great advice because I think that's right. I love that phrase, be our thought partner. That's something I haven't heard before. So thank you for sharing that with us and for sharing that tip as well. And thank you again so much for your time.
Yes, absolutely.
We sure enjoyed visiting with you.
Me too. Thanks so much. This was a fun conversation. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.